people, pedophiles, or people who abuse children. The death penalty would criminalize any person who is a serial offender. It means that any person who breaks the law more than once under this legislation would be criminalized. If a landlord rents out their premises and a person who is known or perceived to be LGBTQ, and they are convicted under this law more than once, they are defined as a serial offender. If any LGBTQ person who is living their life in Uganda breaks the law more than once, that could be speaking out, that could be identifying as LGBTQ, that could be two consenting adults. But as long as you're convicted more than once, then you become a serial offender and you could be executed.
What about two young people, two minors?
That's very interesting. This law that the Ugandan member of parliament are saying is here to protect children. This law would criminalize young queer persons, young LGBTQ persons, and I'm saying young LGBTQ persons who are under the age of 18, to 3 years in prison if they identified as LGBTQ. Well, previously, we have seen that young people, if they identified as LGBTQ, they could get frowned upon, they could get suspended from school or expelled from school. Right now, this law proposes that they should go to prison for 3 years. And 3 years in Uganda for a child, that is the maximum penalty under the Children's Act.
Now, already there is a ban on gay sex. Is that right, Frank?
There's already a law that criminalizes same-sex acts to life in prison. We have the sodomy laws that most of the African countries have that were unfortunately introduced by the British.
Where is all of this coming from? Talk about the trajectory of this increasing targeting, oppression of the LGBTQ community in Uganda.
The oppression we are seeing now in Uganda is not Ugandan at all. The hatred, the radicalization of the Ugandan population to hate and fear LGBTQ persons is not Ugandan at all. The Ugandan society has always lived with homosexual persons, as we call homosexuals in Uganda, with LGBTQ persons in societies. They were never killed. They were never arrested. The homophobia and transphobia we are seeing towards queer and trans persons in Uganda is from the West. It is mostly peddled by extreme American evangelicals. Just last week, we had American evangelicals in Uganda attending a conference that was titled the Interparliamentary Conference on African Values. But the agenda for this conference was anti-gay and anti-gender. In fact, some of the African members of parliament who attended this conference are trying to introduce similar legislation in other countries. For example, Kenya, a member of parliament who attended this conference in Uganda that was heavily supported by American evangelicals, is now trying to introduce a similar legislation in Kenya. We are seeing this anti-gay propaganda and anti-gay legislations moving around Africa. Ghana already has one. We are worried about other countries like Burundi, Tanzania, that could introduce similar legislations.
The Washington Post recently ran an article headlined, "The U.S. Connection to Uganda's Kill the Gays Bill." I want to read from the article. It says, in 2020, London-based Open Democracy, found that more than 20 American religious organizations advocating against LGBTQ rights, safe abortion, access to contraceptives, and comprehensive sex education had spent at least $54 million furthering their agendas in Africa since 2007. Close to half that figure was spent in conservative, predominantly Christian Uganda alone. That's the piece from The Washington Post. Frank, can you talk more about this, and specifically about the U.S. evangelical pastor Scott Lively, who's told the Ugandan parliament that homosexuality is a Western-imported disease?
Scott Lively is an American evangelical pastor. And I'm sure many people in America, in the United States, might not know him. But in Uganda, he's famous. When he first traveled to Uganda and he publicly held meetings with politicians, Ugandan government officials, he told Ugandans homosexuality is a Western agenda that needs to be fought. He introduced Western Western language that was not Ugandan. He introduced language of homosexuals promote homosexuality. He introduced language like homosexuals recruit children into homosexuality. He introduced language homosexuality is a Western agenda. This was not Ugandan language. This was language that was introduced to Ugandans by American evangelical Scott Lively. We worked together with our partner, the Center for Constitutional Rights, CCR, to hold Scott Lively accountable. In fact, we went to court, and for the first time, a judge in Massachusetts said that persecution of LGBTQ persons could amount to crimes against humanity. And for us, we exposed the hatred that Scott Lively was exporting to Uganda.
Frank Mugisha, in 2011, your friend David Kato, who's really considered the father of Uganda's gay rights movement, was bludgeoned to death. Can you talk about the kind of physical violence people face and if the situation has improved at all? And even though it is over a decade later, my deepest condolences.
Thank you so much. I mean, it was very painful, but also worrying for many of us when David, my colleague David Kato was murdered. David Kato was murdered at his house. So that, you know, petrified me. And many people indeed were worried and scared for their own personal lives, but also for the safety of the community. Right after that, a few years later, the situation improved a bit for the LGBTQ community. But most recently, we've seen the situation get worse. Many LGBTQ persons in Uganda have been violated. Many LGBTQ persons in Uganda are getting arrested. There's an increase in blackmail and extortion. There's an increase of social exclusion. And right now what we're seeing is not only crackdown on LGBTQ persons from law enforcement, but we're seeing harassment from ordinary Ugandans. We are worried that if this legislation is signed, we will see mob justice. We are seeing communities, for instance, raiding schools where perceived LGBTQ persons work. We are seeing workshops and events getting raided. We are seeing people getting arrested for simply and getting undressed. Transgender persons on national television are getting undressed. So the situation has gotten worse in the past year and recent months.
You know, you're here in the United States now, lobbying, educating people about what's happening in your country, in Uganda, in your continent, Africa. I wanted to get your impression of what's happening here. According to the ACLU, there have been 419 anti-LGBT laws introduced in the United States just in this year alone. What message does this send to politicians in Uganda and Africa?
That is very good to note. First of all, to see that the issue of homophobia, transphobia, the backlash the LGBT community is facing is not only an African problem, it's a global problem. So Africa should not be seen as the only, you know, homophobic place, but homophobia and transphobia is happening, and it's increasingly around the world now. The signal that these anti-gay legislations that are being introduced in the United States is sending to Africa is not good, because most and some of the text that we are seeing in some of the legislations, for example, in Uganda and other places in Africa, is similar to text of the legislations being introduced here. But for African politicians, this is good. This is good for them. They are using that in saying we can't, even in developed countries, homosexuality is not accepted. And I've seen videos of misinformation and disinformation circulating around, quoting some of the political leaders saying they don't support homosexuality. And, you know, so the politicians in Africa will use anything homophobic and transphobic to try and justify what they are doing.
That's Frank Mugisha, one of the leading LGBTQ activists in Uganda, executive director of Sexual Minorities Uganda. Uganda's parliament passed the anti-LGBT measure in March by a near unanimous vote. The bill is now awaiting the signature of Uganda's president. Visit democracynow.org to see the full interview with Frank Mugisha. Next up, not too late, changing the climate story from despair to possibility. Stay with us. The Amajamal Trio. The legendary pianist died on Sunday at the age of 92. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We look now at the push to address the climate crisis as environment ministers with the G7, the group of seven richest countries, just finished a meeting in Japan on the global energy crisis ahead of a G7 leader summit in Hiroshima next month. This is Japan's environment minister.
Russia's invasion of Ukraine has had a significant negative impact on the global environment and energy issues that we are working on, and the importance of cooperation among the G7, which leads the international community, is heightening again.
Ministers agreed to drastically expand offshore wind power by 2030 and accelerate the phase-out of fossil fuels. But they failed to set a timeline to phase out coal-fired power plants, which are seen as key to reaching critical carbon emissions goals set by the Paris Climate Accord. This comes as a recent study finds current commitments by countries to wind down the use of coal-fired power are likely not enough to meet key targets to stop the planet from warming 3 degrees Celsius by the end of the century, unless far more coal plants shut down in the next 5 years. For more, we're joined by two people, writer and activist Rebecca Solnit, whose latest project is a book she co-edited titled Not Too Late, Changing the Climate Story from Despair to Possibility. We're also joined by the longtime Filipino climate activist Renato Red Constantino, who is an essay in the book that's titled How the Ants Move the Elephants in Paris. about the role he and others played in the Paris Accord. He's deputy chair of the expert advisory group of the Climate Vulnerable Forum. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Rebecca Solnit, let's begin with you. What gives you hope at this dire time when the planet is reeling from global heating? Why do you say not too late?
A lot of people think it's too late to do anything about the problem. A lot of people have given up or think that we're supposed to give up because there's nothing we can do. There's so much we can do in this moment, and doing it matters for the next 10,000 years of life on Earth. We're in the decade of decision. The scientists at the IPCC, the organizers, the policy people know what we need to do. Thelma and I, when we put this book together, wanted to build essentially an on-ramp to activism and engagement, a recognition that we have the solutions, and to also address the emotional impact, because it is devastating and deeply wrong. But one of our sort of axioms we've settled on is despair is an emotion we respect, but it's not an analysis. And so we bring analysis, kind of emotional support, incredible stories like Red's of how the ants move the elephants at Paris, and encouragement, a word that means to instill courage, for people to participate in deciding the future. There's a real sense, particularly in the United States, I think, that the future has already been decided. People in this country love certainty, but so much of it is what we're doing in the present to decide it now. And so we wanted to address the emotional side of things, and we wanted to encourage full participation, which is what will bring us the best case scenario and steer us away from the worst case scenarios.
Well, Renato Constantino, also known as Red, I mean, your essay in this book, Not Too Late, to say the least, is deeply inspiring. I mean, we've covered so many UN climate summits. Beginning each year, it seems there is another storm in the Philippines. You wrote this piece, How the Ants Move the Elephants in Paris, talking about the 2015 Paris Climate Accord. There are projections that say we'll be past 1.5 degrees by 2030. In your essay, many considered 1.5 degrees unachievable, not because of science, but because of politics. The representatives of elite NGOs viewed that limit with disdain. Some even lobbied leaders supporting vulnerable country governments to quash efforts to advance the more ambitious climate goal, claiming this was in order not to harm global consensus. And yet, talk about the story of 2015 Paris Agreement and how you and other activists succeeded in setting a limit, whether or not it's being respected.
Thanks, first of all, for having me on this program. Completely. It was with great happiness that I accepted the invitation to contribute to this book, because we believe very strongly, very deeply, in its title, that it's not only not too late, but it's also urgent that we turn the narratives and stories about the climate crisis into one of possibility, rather than the very luxury that no one can afford, especially vulnerable people, despair. No one can afford it. That's too expensive, because you all are counseled to just lean back on lawn chairs thinking that doom is around the corner, rather than understanding that we're already facing various degrees of collapse at the same time as we're facing a resurgence again, new waves of anger and hope and celebration that we can turn things around, and that when people start working with one another and small countries band with the other small countries, the ants really can move elephants. And Paris, of course, was about 1.5. There are scientific projections that we may breach this threshold by 2030, but there are also a lot of scientific studies that continue to come out saying that though we might breach it, we might also be able to bring it back down, if not below, but there will be a lot of hard work ahead. But hard work, difficulty, does not mean, as the other editor, Thelma Lutuna-Tabua, said, does not mean inevitable. It means it is possible, and we must chase it, just like in Paris. 1.5 was considered a romantic but ultimately doomed target. And the small nations and a lot of social movements just said, this is not a game. Our boundaries are not bound by the politics of those who refuse to let go of their own economic status and lifestyles. Our politics is bound by what our conception is of survival and also our ability to thrive. And that will always drive an insurgency across talks that, while they may get bogged down, there are so many instances in the past that show that the status quo can be overturned and will be overturned if we only bite down on our mouthpiece, so to speak, and fight the good fight without any guarantee, except a guarantee that we will fight harder and stronger and smarter as we become wiser and as we grow in terms of our heft and the public's participation.
And while you're in Washington, D.C. right now from the Philippines dealing with the IMF, the International Monetary Fund?
The IMF is a critical institution. The Bretton Woods institutions need to play a far more relevant role because they were set up ostensibly to manage a global crisis. And they have neglected climate change for so long. And still think that the solutions that we need today are reforms that might actually perpetuate the same order. However, things are really changing rapidly because they see that proposals from the past will not work simply because it's a reinvention of tools that and measures that have brought us to this crisis in the first place. They're confronting the fact that the world economy needs to transform rapidly, but also that the big countries, especially the rich countries, need to play fair, stop cheating, and to start taking action in a far greater way, even as their responsibility lies beyond simple domestic emissions reductions. They also need to play a bigger role in terms of allowing vulnerable countries to transition faster and achieve prosperity. Survival is not enough. We need to do more than survive. We need to thrive as well. And the IMF certainly has a role to play here in terms of ensuring debt relief and in terms of ensuring that there's a universal surveillance of the transition risks and physical climate risks that every economy is facing today in order to trigger a revaluation of assets from fossil fuels to infrastructure to investment strategies that build resilience. The entire economics and the entire way of measuring development will have to be changed in a comprehensive way, but we cannot wait for anything perfect. So we have to keep moving the inches, knowing that when we do the inches, leaps in terms of miles become possible as well.
Rebecca Solnit, you say climate deniers are not really the main problem. And, of course, it seems like there are many more in the United States than in other places. So talk about what is the problem and a framework for change.
The good news is that there's been a lot of surveys recently that show that globally and nationally in the U.S., the majority of people take climate change very seriously. They want to see action. They want to see investment, et cetera. But the problem we face isn't really an environmental problem. It's not a problem of physics. We have the solutions. It's a political problem. We need civil society, the climate movement, to become more powerful than the vested interests. the stagnation of the status quo, to push for the swift transition that is not impossible but will be difficult, will require kind of radical shift in our priorities, huge investment, and profound transformation, ultimately for the better. And so it's really about not about the minority of climate deniers. You know, people in this country often think that we need to be evangelists and convert our enemies. But what we really need to do is rally our friends. If we can get enough participation, and we learned this from history, from the civil rights movement, from the women's suffrage movement, et cetera, we need the critical momentum to overcome those vested interests, that stagnation, that incomprehension by the gerontocracy that runs this country, and to do what needs to be done. And so, as Thelma and I keep saying, difficult is not impossible. We put this together partly because we're nice ladies and we don't want people to feel worse than they should about the situation, but also really as a kind of enlistment manual and a toolkit to send people into action to understand what we can do, how to do it, respect and admire the people doing it already, so many of whom are in this book as extraordinary voices, and to do this thing because, as I said before, this is the decade of decision and we need as many people as possible engaged as fully as possible constructively.
When you look at something like Biden signing off on the Willow Project in northern Alaska, and yet also pushing solar and wind and being seen as a major climate change president, how do you reconcile these two?
And there's two things worth saying about that. One is that it sort of feels like Obama's all of the above, and I always feel like it's like talking to somebody saying, I'm drinking strychnine, but I'm also drinking carrot juice, and the carrot juice is not going to undo the strychnine. You have to, you know, stop drinking the poison. You have to stop the fossil fuel expansion. We already have more fossil fuel sites being exploited than the climate can tolerate. But the other thing about it, last night I was with Antonio Yuhas, who I know has been on the show often, a brilliant oil policy analyst, a contributor to this book, and a longtime friend of mine. And she's saying, despite Willow, the fossil fuel industry is essentially in decline. It's weak, it's fragile in many ways. We can defeat it. But again, we have to be more powerful than the status quo and the vested interests. And that's entirely possible, but it does require, you know, profound engagement, expansion of what has been a growing climate movement, growing in intersectionality, growing in strategy, growing in intelligence about what the pressure points are. And so, you know, I know Earth Justice and other organizations have filed lawsuits against Willow. It's not guaranteed to happen. But we also need administrations that don't even try to do that to say, yeah, this was in the pipeline. Yeah, the permits were in place, but we're going to do a 180 and cancel things like that. We need to be on an emergency footing rather than business as usual. I think they approved it because it was a sort of business as usual thing, and they didn't feel the pressure to disrupt it. We need to be that pressure to disrupt.
Finally, we just have 30 seconds, but what do you hope to accomplish with this book that you co-edited?
I want to give everyone, including newcomers and young people, encouragement to look at the possibilities, to know that there's a lot we can do, to know that the future is not yet written. We're writing it with what we do or fail to do in the present, and to do everything they can.
Rebecca Solnit, we want to thank you for being with us, co-editor with Thelma Young Lutinatabua of the new book, Not Too Late: Changing the Climate Story from Despair to Possibility. Also, thank you to Renato Red Constantino, longtime Filipino climate activist who has an essay featured in the book. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for a digital fellow. Check out democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, this is Jesse Brown, the host of Canada Land, Canada's only media criticism program. Every week I talk to some of the most interesting people in the country about some of the things that matter most. We talk about the news media, about comedy, film, music, and politics. And you can now listen on CJSF 90.1 FM every Monday at 5 p.m. Wait for it.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, British Columbia, broadcasting from the unceded territories of the Coast Salish peoples. Find us online at cjsf.ca and on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and SoundCloud.